Welcome to The Literary Conversation, a podcast celebrating 30 years of the literary consultancy where we ask authors big questions about all things literature and storytelling. Our guest for this episode is the award-winning writer, broadcaster and host Damien Barr. Damien is the author of Maggie and Me, a memoir about coming of age and coming out in 1980s Scotland, a Radio 4 Book of the Week and Sunday Times Memoir of the Year, which he adapted for the National Theatre of Scotland as a play directed by Subha Das. You Will Be Safe Here is Damien's novel of hidden histories in South Africa, linking the Boer Wars with a dark contemporary secret. A Radio 4 book at bedtime and book of the year in The Observer, Guardian and Financial Times. His most recent publication is The Two Roberts, a fictional reimagining of two real-life figures in the 1930s Glasgow art scene, artists and lovers Robert McBride and Robert Colquhoun. Alongside his books, Damien hosted his own literary salon from 2008 to 2023, celebrating new work from established and emerging writers in groundbreaking live events and innovative podcasts. And he was the host for the much-loved Big Scottish Book Club. In his own words, Damien's life is all about writing, telling and celebrating stories, especially those that are overlooked or hidden. Damien, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Aki. It's lovely to be here and it's lovely to see you.
How are you feeling, first of all? I think this is a good icebreaker for me. As somebody who has interviewed hundreds, probably thousands of writers,
yes,
how does it feel being on the other side?
I'm so uncomfortable.
Are you?
I just don't. I much prefer asking the questions to answering them. There's a reason that I don't do lots of interviews, and I think it's because I sort of think to myself, I know what I think. I'm more interested in finding out what other people think. I'm more interested in finding out what I don't know than what I do know.
Yeah.
I think probably. So yes, it's that. I don't think it's control. And I think when I interview people, I often bring my own story to it because I think it's ridiculous to pretend that, you know, there's such a thing as objectivity. But yeah, I prefer asking than answering. But I'm very excited to have you asking me questions because I know you've interviewed many, many, many writers. And you know, you've created this ecosystem of writers and readers, and so I'm excited to hear from you.
Oh, good. Well, I'm very glad. And I think that curiosity that you bring to your interviewing, you also bring to your writing. This idea of bringing more questions than you do answers, I think is a great gift for your writing across your books, which I have here. And I know that this is a podcast, but you can see anyway that I've got your lovely
Oh, look at
books
that.
Here
There you are.
In front of me. And I'm sorry for the sacrilege, but I have, in fact, underlined, highlighted and bookmarked. I don't know how you feel about books as objets d'art. Whether they feel sacred or not.
I wholly celebrate the folding, the highlighting, the, you know, I've done it this morning. Look, I've been reading a book this morning and I'm going to show you the pages. I mean, that's what I do.
That's lovely. What we're seeing for the listeners is a book with many, many dog-eared pages, which I like. And actually, in fact, I do want to start there, which is literature as sacred versus literature as sort of something more democratic. And it feels to me that you really bring this idea of democratizing literature, reading and storytelling. You're a champion for libraries. You do a lot of campaigning and activism. Where does this come from, this idea that for you, and I don't want to speak for you, that for you, writing and literature is for everybody? What drives that for you?
Ooh, let's start off with a small question. I think it's interesting to go back to your question and something you said earlier in it about this idea of the sacred and this idea of, you know, the everyday, and always thinking that they're not the same or they're somehow opposed qualities. I don't want to be all sort of like reformation about it, but I think the sacred is everyday, and I think the sacred is for everybody. And I think that this idea that literature with a capital L is only for the few is a very tired idea, but it's one that's borne out by prejudices and inequalities in publishing, inaccessibility of arts education, a lack of funding for it. There's a sort of, yeah, a sense that it's rarefied in some way. And actually it's not, you know. I'm not saying that there aren't big problems to overcome around literacy and access to education. There are, but every day we tell stories. We all tell stories every day, about who we are, where we're going, what our friends said last night, what we watched on TV, what we listened to on a podcast, what we read on our phones, whether it was, Middlemarch, more on that later or not. And so I think that we're all telling stories all the time. It's how we communicate who we are, and it's how we try and make sense of the world. And literature is one aspect of that. And I think for me as a child, my mum told me stories all the time. She taught me to read when I was very, very little. I learned to read, unscrewing the words, pieces of paper that had been rolled up with words written on them in the words tin. That I can still smell that Golden Virginia tobacco, and I can still remember the rattle of the words tin and the excitement of the new word coming out. And so I could read by the time I got to school, and I was bored very quickly because I read my way through the, like I was like the very hungry caterpillar, basically. And I wanted to instinctively to share that. I wanted, to talk to other people about what I'd read from a very, very early age. And my mum joined me up to the library, Muir Hill Library, which I've continued to fight for with the community and support. And yeah, I think, that's part of it. Part of it is that I was brought up in that way by my mum. I think another part of it is that for a lot of my childhood, I was keeping secrets and ashamed. So, I think before I had the words to describe that I was gay, I had had those words hurled at me as insults. And so I learned to lie and to tell, not be honest about who I was, even with myself, and protect myself and protect the people around me, too, because this was a family shame. And so there's something in that I think about wanting to not be silenced, wanting to be able to speak, to be able to write, to be able to share stories. That feels like that is as essential to me as breathing really is. I get very cranky, I get very depressed and upset if I'm unable to get to my desk and write whatever it is that I'm writing, whether it's for publication or whether it's just for me or whatever it is. I'm sitting here, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold up for you. These are, oops, messy desk. These are, three journals, and I alternate in these journals. I write about the process of writing. One of them is for plot and the research and mechanics, and the other is entirely emotional and reflective, and a space for me to again talk to myself about what I'm doing. So this is a very long answer to your question, and I promise they won't all be this long. We can just do speed yeses and nos if you want, but the fact is that, I bridle against the idea that I'm not allowed to speak because I spent so long being told I wasn't, and actually going along with that. And in the culture that we're living in now, where social media is such a big part of our lives and such a big part of our work, I am a person who, because I am queer and working class and exist in public and try my best not to be ashamed of that, I'm a person who gets a lot of threats and a lot of abuse, and I've had that at events on this book tour with the two Roberts. I've had people stand up and shout abuse at me. I had one woman pray over me. This is a price that I have to pay in order to be able to speak. And for me, speaking is writing.
That it's so interesting that you said the price that you pay, because this is something that comes up in the Two Roberts when you consider when the Two Roberts are looking at Guernica at this really intense moment where Europe's on the brink, and they're wondering, one of them is wondering, what did Guernica cost Picasso, and what did it give him? And I sort of feel like you're talking about that in the, in a similar way, and that the art that you're doing, like, what does it cost you? Why would you do it despite that cost? You've sort of answered this question, but I wonder if that's
No.
something you were conscious of in that
That's
scene.
such a good question. It's such a thoughtful, good, perceptive question. When I wrote that scene, Bobby and Robert are two working class gay Scottish artists. They meet at the School of Art, Glasgow School of Art in 1933. They compete, they support, they love each other, and they win this travelling scholarship to Europe, and they get there as Europe is descending into war. I mean, they wanted to go to Germany and see the religious art there, and I'm so glad that they never actually made it, but I'm not sure they'd have got out. But they look at Guernica and they think, what did it give them and what did it cost them? And I just don't think that that is something that we get to think about or talk about, because I think that being a writer is such a privilege, although it's not always privileged. And I am not myself that, I just, like Bobby and Robert, I don't have any family money to fall back on. There are no deep pockets waiting to catch me if a book fails, or if or AI suddenly eats us all. But I am aware of that risk with every book that I undertake. I'm aware that that risk is not the same for every writer. And that certainly marginalised or minoritised writers are risking more, to go, into those places to create and then go out into the world with that. Because it's not just, it doesn't stop when your editor goes, right, yes, we're done, and you've done a copy edit and whatever else. That's the beginning. That's not an end. And the public life is such an important part of the publishing process now. So I do think you have to think about that. I mean, if I think about Maggie and Me, for example, I was so naive, despite the fact that I've been running my salon for years, I'd worked as a journalist at the Times for years. I really, to think we're thinking about something Darren McGarvey has written about recently in the trauma industrial complex, this idea that we confuse, healing and success. And in many ways, that writing that book afforded me a kind of healing. Touring with that book afforded me a kind of healing, connection, a sense of not being alone and helping people and feeling seen and heard. But it also cost me a huge amount, and after a while I had to say I'm not going to do any more events, because I feel like in some senses, even though the people are supportive and they're coming and they're buying a ticket and they want to be there with you, that I'm having to go back into this place of trauma and repeated exposure. It was like radioactive poisoning. It wasn't the opposite. It wasn't like, exposure therapy. It was hard to, and there are certain parts of that book that I've never been able to read out loud in public. And when I was working on turning it into a play with Shubha Dass in the National Theatre of Scotland and that whole wonderful cast and crew, and so many people that I can't name, but I think, it's a huge, huge production of people. That was another level of that. And in actual fact, and I'll share this here. I was going to be writing another memoir, and having had the experience of doing the play, I was like, no, actually, what I need is a break for myself. And even though I believe, all fiction is autobiography on some level, I needed to not engage with that so directly. So I needed to take a break. So I'm in the process of, I mean, I'm very, very advanced with another novel now, and I'm loving it, and I'm loving being there, and I'm excited to be able to share it at some point. When it's ready to be shared. I don't think that it's something we get to think about or talk about very often. And also similarly about what a book gives you, because the thing about the book is that it finds readers, and every reader gives you something different. Every reader has a different response to it, and at its best, it's this wonderful core. It's not of like ego massage or approval or whatever, because, don't buy a book if that's what you want. It's about them seeing things in the work and bringing themselves to it. And I've heard wonderful things from painters, from artists of all kinds. I had a wonderful email yesterday from a reader in India who had said, you've queered the form in the Two Roberts. It's not just a story of two queer, but you've queered the form of historical fiction. And I see that, and that lifted me. And that gave, they said that lifted them, and that gave them a kind of permission to think about their own relationship. I think that balance of giving and taking changes probably over time as well, and moves more into that kind of giving space. You also have to let it go, and you have to let that stuff in, to, make space for it. I try and leave a lot of space in my text for readers.
Yeah, well, because the readers, the people, you say in your process journals, which you pr a practice you share with several other novelists, including the lovely Fiona Melrose, who has these illustrated process journals, including stuff from South Africa, as you can imagine, which are beautiful in themselves. But in fact, your books are not talking to yourself as much as they are talking to other people whose biases you can't control, whose resonances you have no agency over. And sometimes that's a beautiful thing, and sometimes that's a hard thing. You've talked about this process, particularly with Maggie Marie, as reparative was the word that you've used in interview for it. But I'm actually really interested to hear you say, that you had felt you as GQ's most connected, one of the most 100 connected men ever in the world, to hear that someone, as connected as you, as empathetic as you, as prepared as you, as in embedded in the literary culture, could still feel so exposed and vulnerable in this publishing process. And I would like to, how far you're willing to talk about this, please take your own lead on this. But I do think there is something about duty of care that we're not talking about enough within the publishing industry, particularly when we talk about own voices and the kind of the knife edge of exploitation when we think about people telling their own stories. As we're this is the literary conversation, it's a big thing that we're thinking about. What would for you, what are your thoughts on this duty of care, which sits somewhere between mental health provision, which is not really the publisher's duty, and a basic empathy, but somewhere in the middle there is something that I feel is a missing piece, particularly in a world where 54% of authors polled have said their debut publication was a negative experience for them.
Okay, so there's a couple of different aspects to this question, and again, I want to sort of and again, I want to sort of take it back a stage because actually, I think the duty of care begins with your agent, not with your editor, because it's a part of the process we just don't get to talk about. But I think that I'd spend a lot of time talking to my peers about their relationships with their agent, and I should say I'm, for the record, very happy with my agent. And she's an incredible reader, an incredible person, and works relentlessly and tirelessly for her authors, because what she works to do is understand what her authors are trying to do in the world, how it is we what it is we're trying to say, and to make us aware of the processes, perils, pitfalls, pleasures, all these other things, all of that process of trying to get to say that. And that begins with, in my case, with her and conversations about not like things like, yes, positioning, but also it's much more about, well, why this book now? When I did Maggie and Me, first of all, let me just say that, I had offers from publishers to do Maggie and Me as a novel, which was so unhealthy and bad. Because if you think about me as a person who had grown up in a home where there's a lot of violence, a lot of chaos, deprivation, and poverty, and being told you can't tell people what's happening at home, nobody will believe you. And to then have publishers say, present your life as a work of fiction, it's just so unhealthy, but also so tempting. Because I was poor. I didn't think I was ever going to get published. And actually, that process, of working up to saying no to that offer as a novel, it would just have been so harmful for me. It was a decision that I made myself not to publish Maggie and Me as a novel. My agent, current agent, supported me to have Maggie and Me as a memoir, to find my own voice. And there were other writers who gave me that permission: Janice Galloway, the Scottish writer, Alice Walker, people who wrote in the vernacular, people who wrote in the way, in the words that they thought in, who used language that I was told was stupid or shameful, and who related experiences that I was told I shouldn't ever share publicly. They gave me permission. They blazed a trail, mainly these women, often women of colour and queer. And actually, so that decision, that duty of care, I think those conversations begin actually with the agent, not with publishers and the editor. You shouldn't be having a conversation with an editor that is a conversation that you should have had with your agent, and actually also, with your peers too. I mean, a wonderful writer who shall remain nameless, very early on when I was writing Maggie and Me, said to me, don't ever tell your editor anything you want to come under pressure to put in the book. Her experience of that was that she had to keep herself safe, from that process. And I think once a book is out there, it's out there forever. So you have to think really carefully. And I cut a huge amount from Maggie and Me before I put it out there. But equally, I cut a huge amount from You Will Be Safe Here and a little bit less from The Two Robbers. Because I think there is still a tendency that I don't think straight men are troubled with, but that I think queer people and women particularly are, is that, this, you have no imagination. This must be somehow based on your life. And or we want you to write, keep writing about your life, not to liberate yourself from your imagination. And so with Maggie and Me, there was definitely a sense of, well, what is his first novel is going to be this kind of like funny, gay, sad, Scottish 80s, 90s novel. And I really didn't want to do that. I didn't want to typecast myself. I wanted to feel free to write about whatever the insert word I wanted to. Again, that thrownness, to use a very Scottish word, thrown, that refusal to be sort of told you can or you shouldn't, or which can also come in the way of expectation and hopes. So I wrote, I wrote a novel about South Africa and told the story of one family over 100 years and two mothers and a gay boy. And there's so much of myself in that novel, hiding in plain sight. I mean, there are incidents that I transposed from my memoir, that I cut from my memoir, that I just put straight into the novel and had happened to other people. And nobody ever questioned that. No, like, nobody ever went, oh, and so that shield of fiction was operative. But there were definitely reviews, and I remember, I try not to read reviews actually, but I do definitely remember that there were some reviews that were very much stay in your lane. What is he doing writing about this? And I'm like, does anybody ever say that to Ian McEwan? Has anybody ever said that to Julian Barnes? I just don't think that they have. I don't think that they have. Don't think they've ever heard those words. Not saying they don't have pressures, not saying things are super easy for them, but this idea that your biography to should to some extent dictate the purview of your creative life is definitely not a problem for those people. So, for me, I wanted to, that was a choice, and that again, that was a duty of care that I was exercising to myself. If I write a novel that's like my first novel, that's like my memoir, that's what I'm going to be expected to do for the rest of my life. And I don't want to be Jessica Fletcher as much as I love watching what she wrote. But so for me, what connects, and you said this at the very beginning, what connects my books is that desire to explore a question for myself. What am I finding out about myself? What am I understanding about myself? What am I understanding about the world? What, and these are preoccupations that I come back to all the time. What injustice am I correcting? What am I trying to make better for myself? To what am I trying to resolve or just challenge, even if I can't get to ask a better question rather than find an answer? So it's not, there's not everything is always resolved, and but it isn't in real life. And I tried to resist that in my fiction. So anyway, I did not answer your question, which was about duty of care. I'll answer very directly. I have a fantastic publicist in Anna Frame at Canongate, who are my new publisher, and who did a great job of publishing The Two Robbers. And I have a great editor in Ella Wakatama and publisher in Jamie Bing. And one of the reasons I went to my publisher is because Anna Frame literally wrote the book on author care as part of, as part of working as a publicist. And I've watched her care for authors, whether, that's Len Penny or whether that's Travis Alabanza. I've watched her, understand the needs, understand that what publication demands, and support our authors through that. Whether that is, booking a train that isn't at dawn because it's the cheapest, in order for you to be able to sleep because you've then got to go on a stage, making sure you've got something to eat, but also filtering inquiries, not putting opportunities to you that might be good for the book but not good for you, because actually the two things are the same. And it's got to be good for you, and it can't be good for your book if it's bad for you, is a fundamental. And Anna literally wrote the book on that. So I think author care is hugely important, and particularly around non-fiction, but actually all, fiction, non-fiction, memoir, I just don't see, I just don't think it's reasonable to think that authors don't require like the same basic care that an HR department would give to somebody in an organization. I just don't get it.
It strikes me there when you were talking, Damien, that actually, as a reader, obviously you have these kind of thematic preoccupations, which you've described yourself as this thread that you're always pulling out, or you've just said the question you're always trying to answer for yourself. And as a reader, obviously, I bring my own experiences to your books, even where they're not shared. And so I was trying to identify themes for myself. And then in your speaking about yourself as a writer, I noticed that actually a very big theme, even within the title of one of your books, is safety, which hadn't really struck me until you were talking there, because it feels to me that safety enables risk. And so, and when we talk about, as writers, creative risk is so important. And I, you know, you th this thing that you say about in emails we've exchanged, you've talked about kind of art and activism, writing and personhood, calling and vocation. And I did wonder whether, if you didn't have these oppressive systems that you were battling against, if you had complete creative freedom, do you feel that you would be drawn to the same subject matter for the same reasons? Or would you be, what does being as expansive as possible with no limits actually look like to you?
Makes me realize what a pit pony I am with my blinkers on. I find that hard to imagine. I find it hard to imagine. I think that, I'm looking at a stack of books on my desk for research for the novel that I'm working on now. Books that I absolutely don't have to read, but that I want to read under the guise of working. But I can't imagine that. I don't think anybody can, but I don't think everybody has to. And I think that's a critical tension. So for me, I try and acknowledge those forces, those experiences, whether they're from my own personal experience in the world of the past or in the world now, or of reading other writers. I chose winning that Guardian Top 100. I put, Beloved in there, and but also Giovanni's Room, books where writers have entered the fire for me. And I think that I think everybody's doing that who is trying to say something new about themselves or the world or both, because we are in the world. And I think that's absolutely also true of those writers I mentioned earlier, the fantastically imaginative Julian Barnes and Ian McEwan. Don't know why I'm singling them out, but anyway, I think of Hilary Mantel. I think when I think of writers, I can see that labor. I can see what they're doing, and but I know that labor's easier for some people than it is. Than it is for others, because the consequences of failure are different. There's also different support networks. The famous story of Ishiguro writing, his novel in whatever it was, 6 weeks, doing so-called the crash. There's somebody was there cooking, cleaning, taking care of all those things. I think the idea of having a safety in order to be able to take a risk is huge. And for me, it's really important. I've been married to my husband for a very long time. I've been with him for, my whole adult life. I have friends that I have had my whole adult life, and I have been in therapy my whole adult life. I was able to write Maggie and Me because I'd achieved a level of safety that I didn't have as a child, but nevertheless, I risked all that to do that. I risked a huge amount to write You'll Be Safe Here. And also writing the Two Roberts felt like a real risk because, here I am writing a big queer love story at a time of rising hate crime and crackdowns on LGBTQ plus people across the world, at the same time as, some other countries are decriminalizing and making things easier. So there's this very mixed picture. But it definitely felt like a risk, and to go on tour and have this wonderful response, but at the same time also be experiencing homophobic abuse while I'm on stage, in bookshops, in libraries, in places where we should feel safe, is wild. And talking about it, I just don't want to seem like, a moaner, because it's like, I got to go on tour and I got all that support and stuff. But, I shouldn't have to think about those things. You know, I
Yeah.
shouldn't have to think about those things. And I actually enjoy a lot of relative privilege. At the end of the day, I'm a big white man. You know, I can walk into certain spaces that other people can't. I can negotiate space differently, you know, and even with that degree of privilege, I still have these unwelcome, unpleasant encounters that are designed to stop me working and designed to stop me writing. I think again of Toni Morrison. She says, never just forget that the very real intention of, you know, of racism is just to stop you creating. Just, you know, her words are far more eloquent than mine, and you can find the original quote and please do and read it out because people need to hear it. But you know, I actually had that written above my desk for a long time, because you know I found it liberating. So safety is really important. Because to do something truly creative, you have to be risking something. It's a lot to ask, you know. And like right now, the book I'm writing just now is in so many ways it's so bonkers. But you know, it's about something that I have been fascinated by and obsessed with since I was a child. I'm going to show you something. Where is it? I'm just going to show you this.
Okay.
Now, what I'm holding up for people who can't see it is. And we're not going to describe what's on it. We're going to describe what it is. So I'm holding up a piece of a jigsaw puzzle, right? I'm holding up a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. Now, when last year my mom died, and I on Mother's Day was opened up the trunk that where I keep all the things that are important to me, and I was putting in letters from my mom. And photos and things. And I was really wrestling with what I wanted to write next. And of course, you know, I can only write from where I am. I can only write who I am. So of course this book is going to contain grief and love and loss. And I was having this very direct conversation with these artifacts that I was handling. And anyway, I picked up a box to put in a box, and this jigsaw piece fell out. And I didn't notice it until I stood on it and peeled it off the bottom of my foot and was like, oh. And when the subject of my next book becomes clear, that the thing that's on this jigsaw piece will slot into place. I believe in those signs, you know, and what that was for me was like, you don't feel safe right now. But not taking these risks isn't going to make you safer. You have to take that risk. You know, your silence will not protect you or reward. And it's like, actually, I have to keep going.
I also think there's something craft-based here as well around this safety that you're creating for yourself. Because often when we talk about our own voices, we talk about the lived experience, the real-world impact, which is absolutely valid and we must keep talking about it. But sometimes the craft feels secondary, and I feel like that does a disservice to writers who pour a lot of time into formally how they do the work. And you know, earlier you were saying that you've put bits of yourself into You Will Be Safe Here. There is a safety in putting parts of yourself, hiding parts of yourself in order to reveal to yourself things that other people will not notice and will not know. And I think that's a formal kind of ingenuity that you're doing. And I did want to, I know this isn't really a craft and process podcast, but I would like to hear a little bit about kind of your approach to craft across the, in particular, the memoir versus the novels, only because I did notice, you know, they are your voice, and you've said these are all generated from you, but they are in very distinct voices, each of them, and in distinct shapes. So I wonder how far your process from a craft perspective differed, tackling Maggie and Me, and you don't have to go into to any of the content here, and versus writing You'll Be Safe Here and The Two Roberts, both of which came from moments that you've described a bit like your jigsaw puzzle piece just now.
So I think that, you know, with Maggie and Me, I was working as a journalist at the Times when I started that book, and Two things. First of all, growing up in that situation where, again, being told to keep your secrets, don't tell your story, nobody will believe you. And then also becoming a reporter in an age where, believe it or not, you are not the story. So I didn't write I in my pieces. If I had to write a column, it was a real struggle to be like, oh God, am I allowed to do this? And I think of, Diana Athol, who was a great friend, wonderful editor, and astonishing writer, and she said, it may as well have been inscribed over the nursery wall, you are not the only pebble on the beach. So there's a kind of wider British sentiment of not putting yourself forward. So there were all these barriers to overcome, never mind the fact that this is a queer story, a working class story, a story written partly in Scots. To writing it, never mind publication, right? And lots of publishers passed on that book. Lots of publishers wanted to do it, but lots of publishers wanted to be a kind of misery memoir, or some kind of story of kind of, I would describe, abject triumph. But none of those things account for the messiness of it or the open-endedness of it, because my life didn't end with that memoir. So formally, writing that didn't work until I went into the first person and the present tense, because what I had to do was not remember but relive. And that is what I explore in the play. In the play, I explore the cost of reliving. And in fact, I have Diana come in as a character on the radio at the beginning saying, relive, relive, but in the voice of Maggie Thatcher. Dark. And so, but I had to give myself that permission to write in the first person in the present tense, which was then it came to life and then it happened quite quickly. But that was like 7 years from start to finish. And with You Will Be Safe Here, I wanted to give myself permission to inhabit other lives, but with many of the same challenges. So Sarah Vanderwaught, who keeps a diary, which is the first kind of third of You Will Be Safe Here, she's a woman, wife of a farmer. She's very literate because, we don't think that people in what was then would become South Africa were reading books, but Dickens was sold widely there and read widely. So she's a great reader. Her husband is fighting the invading English, as they're called, even though there were lots of Scots and Welsh too. I had to kind of allow myself to inhabit that space, and I felt I understood Sarah. I understood her desire to protect her son. I understood her pride in her country, and I experienced many of the same things that Sarah experienced in terms of violence and oppression, but she's a different person. So it gave me a kind of safety to explore things. And I didn't need to think, well, what am I doing here? I could think, well, what is Sarah doing here? What would Sarah do? And it was actually really interesting that for me in writing that novel, I began to really truly understand, having never really truly understood the expression, out of character, because I would try and make my characters do these things that I wanted them to do. And it's not that they wouldn't, it's that when they did, it was shit. So I was like, actually, I'm just have to cut that, let's be honest, this isn't working. With Sarah, that first part of that book is first person present tense, like Maggie and me, you can clearly see there's a sort of transition there. And then the rest of the book is close third person, and the tense shifts. And we meet many other characters, and and they are really scary. Some of those characters are really, the general is a terrifying, terrifying racist and homophobe. He doesn't think he is. He thinks he's a good guy. And so I was able to then kind of have that kind of Mephistopheles moment of inhabiting darkness and thinking, well, how does darkness work? Darkness works by thinking that it's light, by telling itself that it is. And that just enables us to, I think, understand how slippery and how tricky that slope is, and how we all have to acknowledge, and this is again something that I'm writing about now, the darkness, the light, the good, the bad within all of us, and the potential for change. So from a craft perspective, that was, but here's the thing, and I've never said this before, but there was a complete other character in the strand to that novel, to You Will Be Safe Here. There was a character who was a gay journalist in the year whatever it was, 2018, writing an investigation into the death of a real boy in South Africa, which is what sparked that whole novel. And I clearly needed to write that to get into that place, but it did not need to be in the final book, so I just got rid of all of it, so there's that. And then with the two Roberts, say I was working mostly on the play at that time. It took much longer than I thought it would. And I had to really push myself to look at stuff. There's a whole act in that play that's one line. in Maggie Me about my older sister having died, which I could not look at. I couldn't think about my sister dying. I couldn't think about my parents' grief, my particularly my mother's grief. And that I was able, because Shuba gave me that permission, that support, to go into that place to do that and dramatize that and explore that on stage. So I was doing all of that. I wanted to get away from myself. So the Two Roberts was a kind of glorious escape. I was living in Glasgow, on and off, and I'd finish, writing a scene with two versions of myself in it, and then I'd get up and I'd go out into the West End and be like, right, what are Bobby and Robert up to? What are they seeing today? What's happening for them? And so they gave me this kind of respite from myself. But that was a question for me of, do I write from Bobby's perspective or do I write from Robert's perspective? And actually, what I realized was, yes, I could do that. I could do a Sarah Waters, and do a sort of fingersmith and split the whole thing. I'm a brilliant writer. But actually, no. What I wanted to do was also write about a relationship that if I took one side, it would just be he says, he says. Whereas actually, if you write about them both, you get to observe the relationship and you get to see what's wonderful about it, what's bad about it, what's sustaining, joyful, sexy, hot, interesting, what's banal, oppressive, destructive, unhealthy, all of these things. And so these choices enabled me to explore particular things. And I'm still playing around with that in the novel that I'm writing now,
I love that you mentioned perspective because also I think you do some really interesting things with perspective where I think a writing class would tell you not to head hop, switch POVs, but you have these little brush strokes where you bring tertiary, secondary, tertiary, and even kind of wider cast characters in a single line. This person's observing this, and it gives this kind of really lovely canvas, I think. But at the center of each of these books is a close relationship, Bobby and Robert, Willem and Victor, people who find yourself and your mother, people who find sanctuary in themselves. And, I don't know whether this is a conscious thing that you want a close, zoomed in relationship, but it feels like it's written with so much compassion and sort of authenticity that anyone needing to find belonging or that safety net, that person, I don't know, I feel a kinship with these close relationships. So I don't know if it was a deliberate choice to have these right at these very, very intimate relationships right at the center of every single book thus far, and who knows about the exciting new one.
I don't know who on this day we attribute the quote, it's in the particular that we find the universal or the specific, but it's been said many times, and it's because it's partly true, that zoomed in closeness is a way of seeing so much more. Like there's this picture that I really love, and it's an electron microscope still of the inside of a plant cell, and if you look at it briefly, you think it's the galaxy, you think it's the universe. And it is to that plant cell, right? That's all it knows. And I think about that scale a lot, that macro and micro, and what little things reveal about a character. So Robert ducks as he walks through a door. It tells me he thinks that he's tall. Whether he's tall or not, it tells me he thinks he's tall. It doesn't tell me he is tall. And I think these gestures, these relationships that are revealed in gestures, and I don't just mean physical gestures, I mean emotional. I've just finished reading John of John by Douglas Stewart, and there's so many scenes, so many moments where there's a line and you just think, well, that's beautiful, and then you go back to it and you go, no, actually that is just telling me the truth about humanity, about the way that two people living in close quarters can love and despise one another, all at the same time, and how much we give away even when we think we're hiding ourselves. And I'm always really surprised when people tell me stuff about my books that I didn't think was there. I'm like, oh right, yeah, you're right. I was talking about, redemption there, or that is what I thought I was saying, but it's not. And so it's interesting. I used to correct people for years when they would say to me they loved my novel Maggie and Me, and I used to correct them for years because I thought that meant they were saying I was a liar, but actually it just means that they've read a story and they love the story, and it's not for me to tell them the story's true or not, because they'll decide. And it's interesting with the Two Roberts, where I described them making paintings together. I described them painting things together. And I curated an exhibition of their work sort of by chance to go along with it, which I started at Charleston, this now at Nottingham Castle, and it will end up at the Dick Institute in Kilmarnock, where Robert Goon used to go. People have written to me about those paintings, and said, well, they didn't paint such a painting, or I've tried to find that painting and it doesn't exist. And I remember saying to them, well, not all the paintings are real. But then I got to thinking about what deeply, and actually what I was trying to say is that whether the pictures hang on a wall or not, they exist in your head first and foremost. So you and I can go and both look at the same picture in the same gallery. We have a different picture in our head. It's not for me to take that away from anybody. So nor is it for anybody else to take that from anybody else. So yes, there is a picture on the wall. No, there is no picture on the wall, but the picture is always in your head and you carry that picture with you. And so when Bobby and Robert see sunflowers, what they have this discussion about, do you think you painted them from real life or not, whether you're sunflowers? And what we see is that actually both those boys by the end of that absorb the heat and light and texture of these sunflowers and the salt clays on the jug, and at any time for the rest of their lives they can summon the flowers to bloom inside themselves. And that is what art does. That is, it's not like, is that picture real where the sunflower's real? It's
It's
the
Frederick the
flowers bloom
Mouse
in you.
storing up the harvest and the colours for
It
the
absolutely is. It
winter.
absolutely is.
I
It
shall now imagine
absolutely
you
is.
and remember you as
Ha
those are really resonant scenes for me. And it just in you talking, it made me think actually, what someone believes really happened versus what somebody feels to be true when they read it are such different things. And so for your readers, in a way, the biggest gift you're giving them is that openness. It's not hermetically sealed. It's that openness to come to the text and complete it by reading it. And I think it's such a beautiful gift that you're giving, and that these books feel trembling with aliveness. I think I've transmogrified your words that you've used in one of the scenes in the Two Roberts when they're looking at something which is trembling with aliveness or vibrating with aliveness. And I kind of feel like that, despite the review. So I this is a personal bugbear. Despite the review of I think sometimes your work is lauded as unsentimental. This is definitely a personal thing, but I think it is sentimental, and that's not a bad thing, and that makes it alive and wonderful. But I'm aware that we are shortly to wrap on this amazing conversation with you, Damien, and I'm just full of gratitude.
Oh,
And we are asking each of our guests, because this is, in order for us to keep writing and to enable writers like you to keep writing, we have to keep reading, because who is reading these books? Who is buying these books? Who is borrowing them from the libraries? Who is pressing them into someone else's hand with love and affection? That is such an important part of the literary conversation that we need to be having. So we
wow.
have some prompts for you. You can answer one, you can answer all, depends on how, alive you're feeling and energetic you're feeling right now. But these
Okay.
questions for you are: a book that changed your life, a book that you think can change the world, and a book that you most want to read but haven't yet found.
So a book that changed my life. I've talked about this before, but a book that changed my life was The Color Purple by Alice Walker. And I reread it, as often as I can. It's a book that I read with my best friend, Mark, as he's called, and Maggie and me at school, and we referred to each other as sisters, and we both had these lives that were dominated by kind of violent men and a desire for something else that we talked about at the beginning as sacred, which, God is having a joke, a laugh when he creates something the color purple. He makes her smile. And I think that book just sort of was such a electric shock to my system. It's like, oh my God, are people allowed to write this? Are they allowed to say this? Are they allowed to swear? Are they allowed to write about sex? Are they allowed to write about how they feel? Are they allowed to write about it in this way where, they are using the words that they say, that they speak? It's just, and I read that at school, and I'm so grateful to my English teacher who gave that to me, and to the librarians who put books in my hands all through my life. So I really do think that that book liberated me as a reader and as a writer, and just as a human, you know. And the film, the Steven Spielberg film with Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey, is one of those rare films that does some justice, I think, to the book. So yeah, so there's that. And then what was the, there was one about a
One that
book
could
that we just.
change the world.
Oh God. Well, I think about that artwork. Is it an Italian artwork? And it's a row of bricks with a wall. And at the bottom of the wall is one book, and that one book at the row of bricks disrupts the entire wall and eventually breaks it down. So I think one book can change the world. It depends who reads it. I think if there are certain books that, you know, if certain leaders in the world just now read them, it might change them. But maybe it wouldn't. Maybe they're not open enough as readers, and that's just a fantasy about the power of literature. I don't know. I have to think more about that. I think I resist the idea that there is one book that could change the world. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Probably.
That's an answer in
Yeah.
itself. And I
Say,
also love
I think
the wall and the bricks.
I think probably the greatest thing we could do is to understand that the books of faith that we use that have been weaponized, to understand those in relativistic terms and in terms of fiction and in terms of our best and worst selves would probably be the thing that would change the world most.
I love that. And then your book that you haven't read yet, but you are keen to.
Well,
And that might
just
be an
is it?
existing one, or it might just be,
Yeah.
I haven't seen this so far.
Well, I tell you, I mean, I just finished reading John of John. I'm very excited to read Maggie O'Farrell's new book, Land. I launched lots of Maggie's books at Salon over the years and a big Scottish book club, and I'm always interested and excited to hear what she has to say and to watch her continuing to grow as a novelist. It's really quite astonishing to think that, you know, with every book she does something so new. A bit like Naomi Alderman, there's a strand of preoccupations, but the worlds are always really different. And so I'm really very excited to read Land. I know that it will go straight onto. There's a bookcase that I have with a glass front on it, which is where I put the books that I know that I will always go back to and reread. And all Maggie's books are there. I remember interviewing her about I Am, I Am, I Am in Edinburgh, which is her 17 Brushes with Death. And the mic, I was so sort of tense thinking about it and reading about it. The microphone was picking up my heartbeat, and it was just like this boom, 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 in this room of all these people. And then Maggie started to go, and then it was like an episode of Casualty, but very literary. And so, yeah, so Land by Maggie O'Farrell probably is what I'm excited to read next.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Damien, for being here. It's been a joy, and thank you for being part of the literary conversation.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for giving me time and place to think, and for all you do for readers and writers.